The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 113, The Smiths, Their Dreams and Visions, Part 2, Joseph Smith and the Family Triangle, by D. Jess Grosbeck.
Aging. So at this point, we'll turn the time over to Jess, and then we'll save some time at the end for question and answers.
Thank you very much, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here with you and this early hour in the morning. Maybe it's not so early. Today I would like to continue my interest in Joseph Smith's life and the family. This is always of perennial interest amongst Mormons. Some 10 years ago, I presented at Sunstone a paper that will have some of the material that I presented then, but this is further amplified and developed. There are ongoing studies in the Smith family continuing, and I think that it's important for us to know the foundations of our faith when that's possible. I'd like to begin by talking a little bit, though, about my general approach to this topic today. Well, psychoanalysis is still my primary field of study and knowledge for about 30 to 40 years. In recent years, I have, I believe, advanced my training in the field of natural families. Without getting into a long discussion of what's happening in the field of psychiatry and psychology, I will only say this, that many theories of psychology, including psychoanalysis, really are coming far short of truly scientific, more scientific principles that need to be involved. And I think one of the latest and best developments in that area is the field of natural family systems, particularly noted, spearheaded by Murray Bowen. And there are several concepts here that shift from the ordinary concepts about individual psychology. And one of them is the idea about systems thinking. Now, most of us know what cause and effect thinking. Up here in line A, B, C, D, E, F, we have a traditional linear concept of A causes B causes D with some influence back the other way. Now, if we move to the next area, we might have what's called multi-causality, where elements A through F are influencing the outcome of E. Let's say we're interested in what E is about. That we understand fairly well. The next level I'd like, though, to look at is simple systems, and that is whereby now we introduce something else, and that is the relationship of A, B, B, C, C, D, D, F. This starts to get systemic in the sense that it is not only the direct influence of the elements A through F that are influencing E, but how the interactions between those other elements are also playing a part. For example, if A modifies B, then B's influence on E could be different than it would be ordinarily. But now let's move to the last level here, and this is what I mean truly by systems thinking, that we're going to try to apply to the Smith family and as we study psychology in general. And that is that systems looks at multi-causality. In fact, causality becomes such a problem, we want to set it aside, and rather than ask the question why, we want to ask what, where, when, who, when, and how. And here we see this six-sided figure here. And please note that now if we isolate item E or any of the items and we want to look at the factors that influence that item, then we have to say truly the whole system is influencing it, because there's no one other area that we can say is causing a specific reaction or influence, because that's also being influenced by every other element. So that's why this then is the key difference between systems versus cause and effect thinking. Now, you may think this is elemental, or you may think it's a little abstract, but I assure you that as you begin to change your own thinking, if you can, in looking at emotional systems, you will come up with very different results than what's ordinarily what ordinarily happens. See, we are in love, as human beings, we are in love with causality. We are in love with motivation. Psychological theories, religious theories about human life are in love with causation. We all want to champion our view of causation. Well, the motivation of this individual for doing such and such is this. And it's only natural that human beings want meaning in their life, and so that's why we are so fascinated with that. But I think, paradoxically, real progress in understanding human behavior may be better done by setting that to the background and looking at an entire system first, more objectively, I think, and coming up with some different answers as to how to be successful in human life. Now, the next assumption I want to go to is that of triangles. Or the next point of discussion. Now, what is a triangle? Well, a triangle is basically a triangle is basically the unit of emotional behavior. I suppose the greatest discovery for me as a psychiatrist in 30 years is to realize that what I'd been studying for 30 years was rather incomplete. For example, we naturally say, well, if you're going to understand an individual, you study that person and who they are. And to the great credit of Freud and Jung and other great researchers, they studied the individual in great depth. They used what we call the one-party relationship, whereby we look at all the factors of an individual's life, we take all the influences and we put them back into their individual thinking, feeling, etc., and try to make an interpretation. And that has great value. For example, if you have a bad carburetor in a car, or something's wrong, you'd better go back and look inside the carburetor and make sure it's functioning right. And that's really what happens, what Freud did and Jung did and many others. It's taken us 100 years, though, in psychoanalysis to come to the next step, which is the two-party relationship. Gradually we began to find, though, that if you study that one person isolated, that isn't really the whole story. What about the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg? Every person who comes close to try to influence that person is having an effect. So what has evolved now in the field is a two-party study, i.e. studying all the influences of the therapist or the observer, whatever, whoever that may be, on that person's life. So you can't scientifically say that all the things happening to that person are just coming from him. It may be that other person. Well, now if we move to the level of the triangle, I think we find a much richer area to study than even the two-party relationship. Now, let me give you a simple example. Suppose A and B are married. And one of the things we found by empirical observation is that two-party relationships are unstable. They can be stable for a while, but then there's anxiety rises in human adaptation and conflict occurs. And there's a danger this relationship will break up or they will split. And the management of that anxiety at a very fundamental level is very, very difficult to understand many times. So let's move on to the next figure here where we have A and B, and notice the jagged line. That's a line for conflict. Well, the most natural thing now that happens is one of the parties, perhaps the one that's the most uncomfortable, person A, will then triangle in a third party, say perhaps a child, and focus attention on that child. For example, they may say to the child, well, a woman may say, Your father is very unfair to me. He doesn't treat me right. And then the child is on the mother's side, and at that point, we now have a third party in this conflict. And so what happens then is at places B and C, we have now conflict because the child will now step in and get into a conflict with the father saying, why did you treat mother that way? And thus, the conflict now has shifted between the child and the father. And maybe the father and the child now have a lot of other issues, and so the battle can be fought there. Now, I want you to note the thing that is most often missed. The key element in this now, what we call a triangle, is that between A and B, the conflict that was originally there is calmed. And so let's say if there was a danger that that relationship would break up, that now can be that worry can be put aside. Because now all the attention is on this rebellious child or this child who's questioning the father, you see. And let me show you how it works in a family in a common way. In this example, let's go to the top there, A and B. This is the father and mother and then a daughter and a son. In the four people in the relationship. Now, in figure B, we see the father and mother, and let's just say at this time, the mother has a conflict with the boy right here. Well, the mother can't handle it, so she goes to the father and said, "Oh, you've got to discipline that son of ours. He misbehaves." So at level D, like we said earlier, the father now takes on the son, and there's a conflict between the father and the son. And notice again, as we said earlier, the father and the mother's conflict, if there was any, the mother and the son's conflict now is minimized. Mother feels better getting along with her son, while father is the bad guy doing the tough stuff. But now, let's say the father has trouble with that son too, and he doesn't like all that responsibility, so he, in turn, turns to the daughter, or the boy's sister, and triangles her in, and talks about what a bad boy he is. In fact, he may say to the daughter, "Look, I want you to control your brother. He doesn't act properly." So now we have the brother and the sister fighting and father in the background. Now you'll notice the sequence here. You see, the conflict now has slipped to another level. And the original conflict between the mother and the son is not a problem. The original conflict with the father is not a problem. The problem is now highlighted there at level between the brother and the sister. Okay, well, I think that's just a very brief introduction to family systems and how we look at things a little bit differently than just looking at individuals. The summation of this now that's going to be important as we look at the Smith family data is that every activity in each family member is affected by and influences every other family member. In other words, and this is a statement I like to make, the emotional state of one member of the family can actually be expressed and experienced by another member of the family. And we're going to see that that's very true as I formulated this about Joseph Smith and his father. But we'll see how this sorts out. Now, one final little bit on triangles is this. Bowen has found that, for example, in marital relationships, there are essentially, there are five, but I'm just going to talk about four major ways of relating between the two parties, particularly when the people are not that differentiated. The first one is through conflict. How many of you have known marriages in which they fight all the time? In fact, you're continually amazed they haven't divorced. But they never divorce. And why? Because in these marriages, the equilibrium of the family, of the relationship, is stabilized by conflict. It's difficult for some of us to see, but that's the case. The next type of relationship that occurs, a very common one, is over-functioning, under-functioning. This is where one of the parties functions beyond the usual for the other, and the other under-functions beyond the usual. This will often happen, for example, when there's a sick spouse, a father or mother, and then the other spouse will have to overfunction, do all the duties of caring for the family, as well as take care of the sick spouse, and thus there's an equilibrium maintained there. See, again, I want you to note, the inference in all human relationships, just like in nature, is balance. How do you achieve balance? For example, the triangles that happen to people and the kinds of things we're talking about now are all in the interest of organisms, of individuals, humans, whatever, attaining a level of balance, of equilibrium, homeostasis, as we talk about it in biology. Okay, and we're going to see this pattern very clearly with the Smith family, with Father Smith and Mother Smith. The next one is emotional distance and cutoff. This is where the relationship is filled with such anxiety that the individuals have to be apart. Father gets a job in which he works 12 hours a day, so he's never home. The mother becomes totally involved with the children, and that keeps the people apart. Or there may be a lot of travel and work or whatever, but they just spend minimal time together so that their emotional life is really very minimal. They don't face each other on an intimate grounds because that would be too dangerous. There's too much anxiety there. The fourth level, again, we're going to talk a lot about this, is child focus. We've seen some examples earlier. In other words, the tension level rises between the father and mother, and so one of them, often the mother, will turn to the child. There may be an illness in the child, a behavior problem, something with the child, and so the energy goes there. And so there's no time to deal with the intimacy of the relationship. It's called a child-focused problem. Now, I think you can see that basically what I've outlined here is a set of patterns perhaps familiar to yourself and your own family, and that most marriages use many or all of these mechanisms of handling conflict and anxiety at some time or other. But what will often happen in some marriages, or at some periods of time, one of these will be the major mode of functioning over the others. Again, it's highly variable here. Okay, now I'd like to move now to the Smith family and talk a little bit about the background here that we want to highlight and try to make some points about what seemed to have happened in this family. I'm going to put up here a little outline for you to reflect on as I just quickly run through it. What I'm going to do here now is primarily just highlight the major elements in the family that set up the stressful. Oh, here we go. Yeah. Now there is something that's not on this sheet. I had not added it yet, and that was that about 1797, the first child was born. Some accounts say the name of that child was Alvin. Some say there was no name to it, so it's not very clear. There's not much information, but I hypothesize that whenever a couple has a child that dies at birth, that first child, that has an effect on the stability of the marriage. But I can't say a lot more about that. Then we know that Alvin was born in 1798. He was the firstborn son, or the secondborn son, but really the first child that lived, basically. And then early 1802, Joseph Sr. Left the farm, moved to Randolph, and opened a mercantile store. And now this is when two major stressful incidents occurred in this family. First, Lucy Mack Smith became ill with tuberculosis, or consumption. She was pregnant, and there she had a near-death experience. This was something related to her family experiences, too, interestingly. There she had a vision, and in that vision with God, she made a covenant that she would go to find the true religion. So it's very interesting. One of the powerful definitions in this family from the beginning with these two parents was this issue of the true religion. And we're going to hear a lot more about that. Now, the second incident of immense importance was the ginseng root incident. Joseph Sr., who was a dreamer and a visionary, we know, gambled. Basically, he took money. He took much of what Lucy had for savings, as well as everything else he could garner from the sale of their land, and he put it, I believe it was $2,000, in this investment to go to the Orient and get ginseng. And what happened was that he lost all that money. It was a scam. And so basically, that put this family in a very destitute position. And in fact, until 1830, this family was extremely poor. And I hypothesize this is one of the major stressful ongoing dynamics of the family that played a part in so many other elements, as we'll see systemically. So Lucy's illness, her visionary experience, finding the true religion, and the ginseng incident. So that religion and money became two big problems for these families. Now, of course, that's a little unusual, but what else is there, someone said. Okay. Now, by 1803, for example, there was a conflict over religion. Lucy wanting to go to the Methodist Church, find the true church. Joseph Sr.'s family didn't like that. They were deists. They were involved with Thomas Paine, Universalism. And they got Joseph Sr. to get his wife to not go there. So the conflict, I think, was beginning to fuel at that time. In Lucy's account, there's a lot of very nice terms about this. It all sounds very kind of like we'll just go ahead and solve this. But I don't think it was as soft as she wanted to make it. Okay, we go through with a verse of the other children. It was in this backdrop in 1805 that Joseph Jr. was born, and then the other children. But now I want to jump on down here and highlight the visions of the father. As you know, Joseph Sr. had a series of seven visions. We only have accounts of about five of those, I believe. We don't know where the others are. It'd be interesting to know what those were. In April 1811, he had the first vision in which he was in a desolate place, and the true religion or the gospel was not on earth. He found a box and tried to eat out of the food that was in the box, but animals scared him away. later in 1811, he had a second vision. And this is remarkably similar to Lehi's dream of the vision in the Book of Mormon. This is where there was a tree, a river, the tree of life. There was a fruit of whiteness. There was a building in which the world was scoffing at him. And in this dream, he wanted his family to be united. It's a very similar vision to Lehi's. The third vision was in 1816. This is 1860, not 1860. That's a mistake. Here's the third vision. Here Joseph Smith Sr. is lame, and he goes into a garden, and these 12 images bow down to him. This will be very interesting. We look at this vision in light of Joseph Jr. One thing I neglected to mention was that in 1812, between 1812 and 1816, was when young Joseph had his leg operation. And this is a very important time, very important element that we don't have a lot of time to spend on, but it had far-reaching effects on Joseph's personality. As you know, he almost had his leg cut off. He had osteomyelitis. He had an operation by a surgeon. You know the famous story where he refused alcohol and wanted to be in his mother's arms over it. And then he spent 3 years basically invalided. And in my opinion, children who are invalided in early childhood or spend a lot of time where they can't move around and do things have a lot of psychological difficulties to adapt to. Their whole body image, many things takes place that are very difficult for them to deal with in later years. I've known and treated many individuals in that category. So this was no small thing for Joseph, very important thing for him. And so in a way, this third vision of Joseph Smith Sr.'s about being lame and seeing the images fall down, we might even say was a dream that Joseph the father had for Joseph the son. It certainly was almost a premonitory dream that people were going to bow down to young Joseph, who was lame. And as you all know, Joseph Smith walked with a limp the rest of his life. Okay, moving ahead now to vision 6 in 18 or 19. In this vision, Joseph Sr. pleaded for forgiveness of sins to God. But he was left out, and his sins were not remitted. Then between 23 December 1819 and the spring of 1820, the last or seventh vision occurred, in which a peddler came to Joseph Sr. in terms of getting into heaven, and he was told that he was lacking one thing. And when Joseph Sr. sought to write down what it was, he awakened and never found out what it was. Now, again, I want to just highlight these visions because they're very important in what they illustrate, what was going on with Joseph Sr. and I think in the family. to me, the most important thing to highlight here, we could go into a lot of areas, but the important thing is to look at this family with the overriding influence of the two parents, which, of course, is usually the way it is. Here was this father who was basically failing to support the family from that 1803 incident on. In addition, we know that he developed, at some point, serious alcohol problems. And again, I won't take the time to read that unless people are interested in getting more details on that. And while the record is not as complete as we'd like, I consider that Father Smith had a serious enough alcohol problem that it influenced and affected his life, the family's life, and his function. He may have had problems with other relationships with women. Again, this is very hard to prove. There's only one vague reference, so I really can't say very much about that. But most importantly, he was very, very non-functional. And we'll see in just a moment. On top of that, this growing conflict with Lucy developed, in which, of course, she is a mother with this large family, wanted the support of a husband, and she became progressively disenchanted. Now, on top of that, we have this other conflict about religion that had gone way back to 1803 and was continuing to fester. And as you know, in a family, when the stresses begin to build, no matter where they're coming from, any old issues just get lighted up further. And I think that's what happened here. Now, notice moving on, in 1820 now, we have the first vision of Joseph Smith, as he describes it. 1823, the vision of Moroni, those visions of Moroni began. And then we go to the next significant event, the 19th of November in 1823, the sudden death of Alvin and the family going into mourning, and then the 22nd of September 1827 when Joseph got the plates in the Book of Mormon. Now, let me again just try to highlight some of this by showing you some of the way I feel that the family triangles, as it were, developed over these incidents. And again, I think that what happened in 1803 with the ginseng root incident, the mother's illness, and then later Joseph's leg operation in 1812, and then Alvin's death, which became the latest and most important element in the family, were the key elements that organized the adaptive and coping ability of this family that was having such a difficult time. So now let's go back to my drawing of the triangles of the Smith family. So I'm sure if the Smith family is a little concerned about this, well, this is the first time it's happened, so we'll just take a chance at it anyway. Okay, let's just, by way of review here, going back now to the 1803 time, here we have the conflict developing between Joseph Sr. and Lucy. Wait a minute. Yeah. And this, I'm hypothesizing, occurred with the firstborn child who died. This may be a little bit soft in terms of evidence, but I think that there was conflict that went back even there. Okay, now we go back to the to when Alvin comes on the scene. He's the firstborn son, and we're at 1803, and this is when the patterns began to develop of conflict and over and under functioning. I've got the arrows going sideways and up. Joseph Sr. was trying to function very well, and Lucy's function was down because of her. Lucy was down because of the loss of the child. His was up. In the next period, when Alvin was born, I think Joseph Sr.'s function began to go down. Conflict continued. Lucy then had to begin to overfunction, and it's very clear in her history that she was really an overfunctioning mother who was stressed with having to worry about economics as well as the children. And so Alvin comes on the scene, and as we see very commonly, this firstborn son now gets called into the family triangle right here to begin to support the mother. And we know that Alvin went on to work very early on. He began to support the family. He became the real father of the family. There's a statement made about Alvin in their devotion to him that he never had a day when he smiled. He was serious. He always had loving statements to make to people, particularly the parents. And the whole description of his personality worried me because he was being called upon to be an adult while he was still a child. And when you see people like that, you worry because there's something that's going to be a problem for them in later years. So here was the original triangles that got going. Well, now, by the time we get down to Joseph and the family, what happened here, Lucy had to carry the load there too. Joseph was ill. Was almost going to lose his leg. And at that point, I think Joseph Smith Jr.'s psychology became very much imprinted by the relationship with his mother. And I think later relationships with women that we know he had a few problems with, particularly Emma, I think have its genesis in this relationship. He was very dependent upon it. He couldn't depend on the father. For example, the father just cried and almost was like a child himself when that whole operation was going on. And then they sent him away for a period of time, and so there may have been an abandonment issue there too. It was hard for Joseph. So these are some of the factors that were going on. Now let's move ahead. And now we're going to see the development of what I call. Now, you may ask the question, what happens if you have more than three people in terms of a triangle? Well, what you get, we find, are interlocking triangles as a unit of behavior. And we'll see how this works. Now, by 1818 and even earlier, we have Alvin identified with the mother being more of a husband, father than the father. And I think that was one triangle. It became a source of tension. But it kept the family afloat. And we don't know what the relationship with Alvin and his father was. I suspect there must have been some conflict, but probably not a lot. The father was probably very grateful to Alvin that he was doing what he was doing, filling in for him. So there was an intensity then between Alvin and Lucy with Joseph in the third position. And let me just say, in a triangle, usually what happens, there are two people in the in position and one in the out position. And that can shift around. And in fact, as we noted earlier, you see, the balance of the relationship between two people is often maintained by that third party who can kind of keep things in balance. Now, on the other hand, another triangle was developing between Joseph Smith Sr. and Jr. We know their identification was very strong, and that was because of their visionary nature. Joseph Smith Jr. was a visionary person. He was a psychic. Have any of you ever read about people who solve crimes for policemen? They go into the garbage dumps and solve the murder because they have these psychic abilities. Well, in case some of you didn't know it, that's the way Joseph Smith was. Had he never gotten involved in religion, he would have been one of those very sensitive psychics. There's no question about it if you read a lot of the history about what he did. And the father, of course, was very visionary. He was interested in treasure digging, of course. And, of course, all along, the father was trying to hit a home run and recoup all that treasure he lost. So that pattern developed early on, you see. So we have then two interlocking triangles, Joseph Sr. and Jr. With Lucy in that out position, Alvin and Lucy with Joseph Sr. in the out position. And, of course, along the road, Joseph Jr. was trying to develop a relationship with his brother Alvin, and he later, of course, relied a great deal on his brother Alvin. Okay, now we go to the 1823 period, and I think that all of this really intensified, basically. And my theory is, this is my interpretation of the data, is that the anxiety level in this family by 1823 was so great that it made a significant contribution to the death of Alvin. Now, how Alvin died, of course, was he ate something, I'm not sure what it was, he may have had some intestinal obstruction, and then some quack doctor gave him some Calomel and he died, probably the intestinal obstruction. And while I realized that was the way he died, I believe that that whole incident, as so many other natural incidents of illness, are connected to the family system. For example, most people who get a gallbladder attack don't get it just any time. Granted, they may have gallstones, bad functioning gallbladders and so forth, but so often you'll see the timing of that eruption when they have to have the operation connected to some family system connection that's very important. And so that's my hypothesis, that's what happened with Alvin. Now, again, let me emphasize how important and powerful this incident was. Alvin was over-functioning tremendously, supporting the family. They were living in the frame house. They had bought it, trying to pay for it, farm it. And we know that after his death, they eventually lost it, even though they were able to stay on the land for some time because of renting. He was clearly the leader of the family. And there are even stories to suggest that he was going to be the prophetic person in terms of the treasure to be found or whatever spiritual experiences they were going to obtain. And so when this happened, I think that a divorce was imminent and even became more imminent after he died. Now let's go to the next chart. Again, I've described this. Again, this may be a little inaccurate. A divorce, of course, did not occur, but I think that it was in the offing. And I think its best manifestation was that at this point, Lucy took most of the children and joined the Presbyterian Church within a year, by 1825. Joseph and his father did not. The other reaction was that they were very upset because one minister had said that Alvin was going to hell because he had not been saved. And so this religious conflict issue became just boiling over. In fact, so intense was it, this very peculiar thing happened. Rumors had it that Alvin's remains or bones had been dug up. And so concerned about this was the father. He put an ad in the paper about it and went and re-dug up Alvin's bones to see if they were there. Well, they were intact. Well, the father or Joseph or something. And this was very kind of a strange thing. But I think it reflects the level of anxiety, if nothing else, and how much Alvin meant to the family. So that basically, you see, this religious conflict, this money conflict, this economic conflict now was just screaming outside in the singular event of the death of this boy, who was the supporter of the family And now the religious issue of how do you get saved is even more acute. And I think then that just led to the split. You can see how this would naturally occur. Now, in natural systems theory, when a family approaches this level of crisis, Murray Bowen used a term that I think is very valuable. He called it an emotional shockwave. What will happen is when the death of an important person in a family occurs, it will have shockwaves that will ripple through the family. Now, very often, these rippling effects will be ascribed to other things. In fact, one of the most remarkable things is how families deny the connection between the shift in the power structure of the family and the death of that important person. They'll say it's always due to something else. But anyway, let's take a look at this now, what this shock wave was in the Smith family. Because there was now a fundamental rearrangement in position, power, authority, direction, function. Everything had to readjust itself. So there was grief, depression, and loss, with Lucy particularly, and the father, everyone actually. Joseph was very depressed. And so what do we have? Well, what will often happen in a family is that there'll usually be a shift to take over a position that's been vacated. And in this particular situation, when Alvin was gone, the person called upon was Joseph Smith Jr. He was called to step in. Now, you could argue that Hiram was in that too, and in a way he was. Time doesn't permit to go into all of this, and obviously there were triangles and other relationships with Hiram and the rest of the children, but I really think the central and most important ones, as we saw the shift of the family, became Alvin and Joseph. So basically, by this time now, Joseph, he had had the vision of Moroni, and the visitations had begun. And from 1823 to 1827, many things happened. The family's functioning went down in terms of their economic situation. They lost the farm. The division in religion took place. I think this was the time when the marriage was in its greatest crisis. And finally, then, of course, Joseph, when he got the place, called upon Emma. And it's very interesting that their firstborn son, Joseph and Emma were married in January 1827. He got the plates in September 1827 and was going ahead and translate the Book of Mormon. There's one statement that suggested that he thought the son was going to translate this record. And it shows you how much investment Joseph had in his brother Alvin and that death, trying to resolve the grief of that loss. So now what am I saying then? Let's come out of my final picture here. Kind of a hurried trip through here. Just to highlight this, basically, what I'm saying is that Joseph Smith Jr., now speaking for him now from a natural systems point of view, and looking at the emotional cauldron out of which he came, he was a member of this family in tremendous turmoil, tremendous emotional struggle. And his position was, he was called upon to step in the position of his brother to take over the support of it. And I think it's probably true that any child, or most children in a family, when the parents are about to divorce, do everything they can, consciously and unconsciously, to try to save that marriage. It's like an adaptive function. It's like that becomes number one item. And I really think that if we look and now interpret Joseph Smith Jr.'s behavior experiences in this light, we have a very interesting result. Basically, through Joseph Smith's visionary propensities, and beginning with his father to find treasures, to, of course, make money and recover the family fortune that was lost, we saw how that all shifted over into a religious context. We know that the treasures of the gold plates and so forth, the whole story of the Book of Mormon was tied up with the idea of translating this ancient record. But there is one account that suggests that Joseph was tempted to make money on the deal, which he turned away from, because there was a spiritual component. Now, on that side of the coin, this was an attempt to cure his father, to help his father get beyond the physical, the mundane, and deal with the spiritual side of life. Turning now to his mother, what did he do for her? He helped his mother realize that, well, she wanted to go to, well, the Presbyterian Church. And I suspect that the religious battle was over going to whichever church, and finally the Presbyterian Church versus Joseph Sr.'s idea, no, to no church. Well, Joseph comes along, of course, and with the restoration of the gospel of Christ as it came to Joseph in the Book of Mormon, the answer for Mother was, wait a minute. None of those churches are the true churches. I'm going to show you where the true church is. So it's almost as though a third way was carved out for the parents to resolve their differences. It's almost as though Joseph, you see, in uniting the struggles they were having, he created a third path for them. And through the restoration of the church, I believe he calmed that relationship down and helped them find a new way. They certainly solved their financial problems as things moved on, and they solved their religious problems. And we know this from the theory of triangles, that if a third party to two people in conflict can, in a calm way, deal with both individuals and their needs without taking sides, without saying, well, you're wrong and he's right, and you're wrong and she's right, it will calm the other two. In fact, one of the most powerful and important therapeutic techniques, yet I hate to use that word because it shouldn't be a technique, it has to be a way of thinking, that if you sit down with two people, a married couple, for example, and you do not take sides and you help both parties learn to listen to each other, it's incredible what happens. For example, I have treated many couples now, and the only agenda I have when I sit down with them, and I keep my focus on that entirely, is to stay in a neutral position. I help them listen to their story and process it through me and let the other party listen and vice versa. I don't make any judgments, interpretations, or statements about, well, you're right, you're wrong, etc. I basically get them to begin to listen to the other party through them, and it's an automatic thing. The calming starts to take place. Well, all that to say then that I think that Joseph Smith, in a remarkable way, basically saved the marriage. Now, let me just take you back to some of those statements. Go back and reread the first vision story. Joseph's preoccupation with religion. Which church is right? Or are they all wrong? My mind was given over to reflection again and again. What is this? I don't think this is just a 14 or 16-year-old boy's reflections. I think he's reflecting this ongoing anxiety of the parents. He's carrying their anxiety. And any of you who don't believe that, just go talk to the next child or children of yours in which you hear them articulate your very anxieties or the anxieties of the parents. The whole issue of money, you see. The whole issue of forgiveness of sins. For example, there are two significant accounts of the first vision. In 1832, the earlier account, we know that Joseph sought for forgiveness of sins. That was the primary issue. In the 1838 account, there was the issue of which church was right. Well, you know, probably they're both correct, but you see, both of those questions were burning questions. I think Joseph was very worried about the sins of his father. He was party to that, you see. And so I think if we reread a lot of that, we can see it. Now, one final point. This whole discussion that's been going on for many years about the first vision, was it fabricated, was it not? No, I don't think it was. I think he had a vision in 1820, 1821. Perhaps the date is wrong. But the important point here that produces some distortion in Joseph's writings is that the 1838 account goes back and hypothesizes a revival in 1820. I don't think the historical evidence supports that at all. The revival did not come until 1824. And I think Lucy's account is the best one. More fundamental issues of the family, the forgiveness of the sins of the father, or all the other issues that are going on with Alvin's death. I think Alvin's death was so painful to Joseph, too. He wanted to move away from that. It has the typical hallmarks of individuals who remember emotional-laden events. They will cover them over. They will misrepresent the date, in a sense. So I don't think that's a critical factor in any major accusation against Joseph Smith. I think, to me, it fits very naturally into what took place. But what we've seen today, I think, and the point I want to emphasize, is we've seen this whole family struggle, this family conflict, this emotional turmoil, the emotional shockwave that occurred with the death of Alvin, and how the family handled it, and how it got transformed then to another plane, the religious plane. And of course, the Smiths became then this marvelous family in the church and in the world. Again, I don't think Joseph Sr. Ever really functioned very well. He functioned better than he did. Lucy always functioned much better. But I think if we read some of the statements that Joseph made about his father when his father was baptized, how he cried, a lot of this now, to me, makes a lot more sense when we see this more systemic view. That concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
You can just stay here and we'll answer questions now. If you can speak loudly or come up to the microphone, that's fine, just as long as we can get them on tape. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the question was, what about the influence of Hiram on Joseph? Well, I think, and I haven't done as much work on Hiram as I might do, but I think Hiram, of course, was a very supportive influence on Joseph. I don't see any evidence that he went against Joseph as he tried to carry the load. Actually, he assisted him a great deal. Now, we know the one period of time when he went against Joseph was over plural marriage, when he was closer to Emma than Joseph, until he got converted by Brigham Young. That was in the 1840s. But other than that, Hiram was always kind of in the background. I suspect Hiram was one of those children in a family that was able to kind of stay out of the main line. See, if you were raised in a family in which you got let alone, that was your greatest blessing. But if you were the oldest or one of those children that got targeted to be the special one or the rejected one or you better do this or to accomplish that, that's when you got problems because you're drawn into the triangle of the parents. And I think Hiram kind of stayed out of that. But my impression is that Hiram, throughout at least this period, was certainly supportive of Joseph, and I know he was one of the factors, major factors, that helped do the hard work they had to do. See, Joseph worked very hard. Those Smith boys, there have been these accusations the Smith boys were lazy. Well, that's just ridiculous. They were not. They may not have worked as hard once they lost the house, because now they didn't have anything to work for. They were just paying rent, 1825-26. But they were hard workers. And so that's probably the case with Hiram. One other thing, he did go, though, with Lucy to join the Presbyterian Church. So he, in terms of the triangles, during that period in 1825, he joined Lucy. And that's when the family was on that division course, you see. Comment.
Unusual.
Yeah, question was, what about divorce? Was there an actual divorce discussion between the parents? I can't pin that down specifically, there was. I'm reading it into the narrative. And I think you're quite right, your implication, that a divorce would have been a really big thing, very big thing. And when you consider how destitute they were, and when you consider the options, particularly for Lucy, they weren't that much greater. You talk to a lot of women today, and they will say, I didn't get a divorce because I had no better options. But as soon as a better option shows up, yes, I'll get a divorce. So, and when you look at the history of how incompetent Joseph Sr. was and his alcohol problem, and continuing, I mean, for example, you know, they come to get the house payments or take over the house. He's nowhere to be found. Alvin and the mother have to take care of the responsibility. He's just an absent figure. Comment.
I find it very interesting. Was it my great grandfather was Samuel Harris in his family, and sort of studied and analyzed the family
Yeah, the younger children often, and this is a question about Samuel Harrison. We have one of Samuel's descendants here in the audience. Well, that's a great honor. Yeah, we don't hear a lot about him. Younger children, particularly when these conflicts are occurring, often are in the background. They'll later develop their triangulation. You see, I think the other thing that's so beautiful about this theory of triangles is it, for the first time, theoretically, tells us why we all have different parents. See, for many years, psychoanalysis, many other systems have said, well, you know, so-and-so has a problem because they have this terribly intense relationship with their mother. The mother didn't treat the child right. And some of them say, well, wait a minute. The brother was raised right along with them. Why aren't they that way? Well, the theory can't explain why that other child is different. Well, if you understand triangles, you do. Because if you're in one triangle with your parents and your brother or siblings in another, it's a totally different ballgame. And one of the most shocking experiences of my life has been to go back and interview my brothers, my two brothers, older and younger. And believe me, when you hear their stories of how they perceived our parents, our mother and father, it's like they had different parents. Because the parents dealt with them differently, different timing, different relationship. And so I think that Samuel, back to that question, I think was dealt with, and the younger children were differently. The key players at this time as those conflicts developed were Joseph Jr. and Alvin. I haven't studied, you've studied Samuel's life enough. It would be very interesting to go. I'd like to talk to you if you have more information on his life, because I've never read that much about him, to see, you know, how that all sorted out for him, because he came in when things were much better and different. And he had a totally different world, I think, than those other older boys. Well, that's a good point. Question was, what does family systems have to say about people like Joseph Jr. who gets caught in a triangle of this nature? How does it influence future behavior? Well, you're very definitely right. That would be the next statement. I think Joseph's relationship with his mother. You see, Joseph was. I think he was in a very anxious position. Those reflections before he had his vision and those experiences with Moroni. And those visitations of the Book of Mormon, he was at a very high level of anxiety. He was much too serious for the average adolescent. And because he was trying to balance out, he was pulled by his mother and loyalty to her. Yet his father was pulling him too. And he was the one kind of on father's side, you see. And I think that conflict played a part. Now, for example, there's one statement that he made in which after Alvin died, he said, I was so lonely, I had to get married, so I found Emma. So in a way, you see, Emma became his compatriot. That's why he was so tied to Emma. See, Emma helped him through this crisis. See, she really helped him. And that's why he could never really turn his back on her. Because that early connection, I think he would have had a lot of trouble doing what he did without her. But on the other hand, I think that perhaps, this is what I would speculate, the bond with the mother between 7 and 10 was so strong that he was very uncomfortable in a close relationship with a woman. If he got too close to her or too committed to her, it may have bothered him. He may have had to move away from that. And so that would certainly be one of the bases for his move toward plural marriage. The other side of that, of course, to your question, would be if he identified with a father who was visionary and who may have had some other relationships, that would be another element. You know, interestingly, if you set aside the glitter and gold and the level of success, Joseph Jr. followed a bit in the path of his father. He had financial troubles, and he had trouble with men, and he had trouble functioning with men in relationships with men. And that's Joseph Sr. right down the line. Though Joseph Jr. was much more successful than his father, yet if you look between all the content of that, you see that going on. And then your final part of your point is, in a triangle, often a child, particularly where the triangle is intense, in that next generation, when let's say they marry, for example, Joseph marries Emma, very often they'll just move up in the triangle. They'll repeat the triangle and just take a new position. And that's most likely what Joseph did with his father. He just moved into that position with Emma. Comment back here, Madison. I don't know, but the question was Joseph Sr.'s alcohol a facilitator in his visions? We don't find specific mention of that. I suspect Lucy wouldn't mention it, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, that would not surprise me if that were the case. I think his alcohol problem was far more extensive than was admitted there and so forth. Comment back in the back. All we have is Lucy's account, and that was written down much later, in 1844. Interestingly, though, the other data in Lucy's autobiography, which is the best, is consistently held up to be a very good historical document. There are problems with it, but you talk to all the historians I know, and there are a lot of them, you know, that are really going into every facet of this. So in her favor is the fact that many other incidents you can verify are fairly accurate. But now whether those visions were, you know, you have a good point, because I'm always suspect of somebody who tells me a dream they had 10 years ago. It's probably gotten a little bit of elaborated there so far. Yes. Comment.
Could you comment what other sources are important to your kind of analysis? Obviously, Lucy's account was very important.
Well, there's a whole body of knowledge. Dan Vogel has done us a great service. He's collected all those Mormon documents in two volumes on early Mormon documents. And I think those are just marvelous. There are neighborhood accounts. We have to look at those. Many of us in the faithful camp don't like to look at some of those neighborhood accounts, but they're there. Again, trying to be objective, in terms of the events that took place. There are neighborhood accounts. There's Joseph's own account. We can't dismiss it. Very, very important. I think that 1832 account of the first vision is very, very essential to put this in the context. But I think if you picked up Dan Vogel's first volume, you'd have in your hand, you don't even have to look, the major documents you need to go through and explore that period. For example, you know, the whole history of the four visitations to the hill are all very different than what we have refined out in the religious theology. Not that they're false, it's just that there was more to them. Let me see. Or read Michael Quinn's, Michael Quinn's Magic World in the early Mormon Magic Worldview. That's been reprinted, by the way. Comment. Well, one, that's a whole interesting topic that I want to explore a little more carefully. But the question was, what about Joseph and Emma and in a triangular relationship in polygamous? What's that? Yeah, you have to go back and draw the system. You have to take the individual involved. But clearly, I can just make one preliminary comment about that. You can certainly hypothesize, without a great deal of speculation, that as the anxiety level built in the Emma-Joseph relationship, particularly having children and then children that die, see, many couples start having their anxiety when those third parties start coming in the door. You know, they may do fine together, and suddenly here comes the third party, and boy, it upsets the apple cart. So it may have been that with whatever levels of anxiety were beginning to grow between him and Joseph, he would then move to triangulate in a third party in a polygamous relationship. And Emma knew about that fairly early on.
How did it go between him and Joseph?
Well, it may have calmed some of their anxiety, strangely enough. See, many people don't like to hear this, but oftentimes an affair in a marriage will calm the marriage down. Or, of course, it can break it up. We often hear that an affair will destroy a marriage. And probably most often that is the case. But I can show you many examples in which an affair, a third party triangling, and calms the situation down. So that well could have happened with Emma and Joseph. Now later, of course, Emma got more and more upset about that, and you know that wasn't that was more problematical.
We have time for one more question.
Sure, tell me here.
I remember you making a mother.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, the father really, he kind of broke down. I don't think he was much of help at all. I don't think that's correct. So. But either way, it was a very traumatic incident, for sure. Well, if there are further questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Thank you very much. Pleasure's been mine.
Well, we'd like to thank Jess for this very interesting and enlightening presentation, and you're now ready to go to the next session. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much.
I'd like to even be able to see it written out of the course.
Yeah, I'm going to try to write this up. Melvin, how are you? You bet. Good.
I really enjoyed it.
I'm going to try to get it up for publication, right? If whoever publishes it, I don't know who will, but we'll see. The first one is in Sunstone. In fact, I think the issue is out there. It's in 86. A lot of the background I've given you is in there, but I didn't really have the knowledge of triangles and systems then, and it's much more comprehensive. I mean, I feel much better about this.
It's
putting
in Sunstone, March 1988.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you, Melvin, sometime about Samuel and some of the others, because I'd like to explore the Smith family in more depth, you know. So. All right, you bet. Okay, great.
They talk about alcohol,
just that,
which you
verified.
Yeah.
But you've also said, they also said they were indolent, and you kind of discount.
Right, right. Yeah, well, the alcohol, that's pretty. See, there's a pretty good statement. I mean, Hiram records that about his father's problems with alcohol. I think that's pretty documented. We'd like it a bit more documented. But, again, I would only recommend that as you do that, you're careful. You don't just, my approach to this often is you believe everybody, you believe nobody. And then you try to see how many cross-checks you have. But I think Quinn's work is good, and Dan Vogel's written some good things. Though Dan, of course, has a bias, too, a bit. I have some. Joseph drank. I don't think it was a big problem, but he drank. Yeah, he drank with his father. Yeah. And you remember he sent the 12 out for wine, many times, and he had whiskey at the time of his martyrdom. So it was.
Thank you very much.